Hi, everybody. Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I am Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is engineer-producer Richard Chickie. But first, let's talk about music's top 1%. Yes, it turns out that music has a 1% as well, and I think we all knew that. Actually, it's probably more like a 1% of the 1%. But one of the things that actually bears this out is a couple of facts about streaming from the last few years. First of all, it's been found, looking at all the streams from 2013 and 2014, that the 10 most popular songs got about 2% of all streams. So let's put that into perspective. A typical listening session goes about 3.5 hours. Now, you may think, wow, I don't listen to music that long at any one time. But probably you do. You're either listening in the car, you're listening at work, you're listening as you're doing something else. And the typical music listening session is a lot longer than we think it is. Well, it turns out that in this 3.5 hour session, the chances are really good that at least one of the songs you're going to listen to is going to be in the top 10. Even though you may not like that kind of music, chances are it's going to appear. Now, something else came up, and that's that 1% of all artists get about 80% of all the revenue generated for artists in the music business. Amazing, huh? It just goes to show you that just like the rest of life here, it's pretty much run by the 1%. We don't want to hear that, but it's kind of true. And I think inherently we knew that anyway. So when we look at streams and when we look at downloads and we look at music sales in general, what we find is that, yes, they're dominated by the things that we hear on radio, by the artists that we hear on the radio. And is that a bad thing? Well, yeah, I think it is, but it's kind of the way it's always been. And even though we have a more democratic music society, so to speak, that's still the case, and it will probably be that way for quite some time. There's a couple other music industry things I want to talk about. First of all, Spotify came out with something very interesting last week, and it's called the Touch Preview. So the way most music services are, you have to select a preview, and you get 30 seconds to listen to it. But this is a touch preview, meaning that as long as you keep your finger on it, if you have a mobile phone, for instance, as long as you keep your finger or the mouse depressed, it's going to play. Why is that important? Well, for one thing, what it does is allows us to go to another song a lot quicker. It's just a quicker way of deciding what we don't want to listen to, more so than what we do want to listen to. So that's kind of cool. And finally, one other little bit of music news. Apple bought a company called Symmetric last week. And what's significant about that is they own a service called MusicMetric, which has tracked sales and pirated downloads and social media for labels and managers since about 2008. In and of itself, the sale doesn't mean much, but there's some speculation that this may actually be folded into the new Beats Music when it's relaunched later in the year. And what that will mean is that artists and labels will have greater analytics to see who's actually listening to their songs. And that will be something that's worthwhile because analytics gives us power, so it's always something that we want. Now let's talk about some audio. The MIDI standard is celebrating its 30th anniversary. Yes, MIDI has been around for 30 years, and a lot of you don't remember what it was like before MIDI. It was miserable. Basically, if you wanted to connect your drum machine, your sequencer, and your synthesizers together, so they would talk to one another, you could only buy from one manufacturer. In other words, Oberheim would only talk to other Oberheim, Yamaha would only talk to other Yamaha, and Roland would only talk to other Roland devices. And that put a crimper on everything because if you happen to like a Roland drum machine or a Yamaha sequencer or a sequential circuits synthesizer, they wouldn't talk to one another, so you were very, very limited. And what MIDI did was basically democratize all of that by having this universal standard where one machine can talk to another. And this was actually put together by Sequential Circuits president and founder Dave Smith. Now it's 30 years down the road, and there's a new MIDI protocol, and it's called MIDI HD. And this is a more robust version of MIDI. And what you're going to find, it has plug-and-play network connectivity over USB and Ethernet now. So instead of having that MIDI cable that we've all come to hate, I think, because of, speaking of robust, this is not. Now we have a new way of connecting together, kind of a more modern way, USB or Ethernet. That's very cool. The other thing is, it's going to have thousands of channels, so you can have some very, very complex systems. It will have some more precise pitch and articulation that will really help an artist be more expressive, so that's kind of cool. It's also going to have some tighter timing because everything is going to be time-stamped, as well as more controllers and parameters, and it's going to be backwards compatible with MIDI 1.0. So this looks like it's pretty cool. However, I don't think that it's really going to catch on in a big way. Yes, it will catch on, but it's more expensive than the current MIDI, so that will stop a lot of manufacturers from putting it on some of their cheaper devices, first of all. But there's another standard that's coming on strong, and it's called AVB, which stands for Audio-Video Bridging. And AVB is a standard for transporting audio and any kind of other real-time content over Ethernet. This is going to be the next big thing, and you're going to see everything with an AVB bus on it pretty soon. And this will be a way of easily talking not only from one machine to another, one computer to another, but also sending audio very, very quickly and easily just about anywhere you want over a venue or between a system. We're going to talk more about this in the coming weeks, but I want you to be aware of AVB. Because pretty soon, it's going to be everywhere. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. Don't forget about my new coaching program, which is 101 Mixing Tricks. It's big studio tricks for the small studio. You can go to 101mixingtricks.com to learn more. My guest today is engineer-producer Richard Chickie, who's worked with everyone from Rush to Dream Theater, to Aerosmith, to Def Leppard, and Mick Jagger, and many more. As a matter of fact, he has 26 gold and platinum records just from Rush alone, which is very cool. I spoke with Rich via Skype. Richard, thank you so much for being with me today. This is great.
Yeah, amazing. Thank you, Bobby.
I'm a fan. What can I say? I'm a big fan of your work.
And likewise. We both seem to do... We share quite a pass as far as 5.1 surround because we both know Moog speakers is better.
I want to get into that with you, but first let's go back to the beginning a little bit. You started playing in bands first. You weren't a studio rat originally, right? You were just a musician like everybody else, right?
Absolutely. I was a guitar player, and I started recording, because I did not know any better. I thought that's what you did as a musician. You recorded your band as well, right? So this is way before there was any sort of formal, we've got all these outlets for formal education. This just didn't exist. I was a young guitar player, and I wanted to record my music, so... picked up a machine, a bunch of kids in the basement recording our music, and it just literally just expanded from there. All of a sudden, I'm playing session to session. I have my band trying to get a record deal for my band, and I was recording, in a rehearsal complex / studio, so there's traffic of other bands, and they'd say, "Hey, man, you want to record me?" And it just went from there. The recordings kind of spread out a little bit, went to record companies. So, it was social media at its finest in the very early days. Hey, before there was any of that, internet there, yeah. Bobby.
person to person social media.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Which turned out to be the best thing,
So where did you get your studio chops then?
My studio chops were the RCA recording handbooks, read ad nauseum. It was when I wanted to learn about SSL, I'd heard about this legendary console called an SSL, and I cold called the distributor. I was living in Toronto, Canada, and I cold called the distributor, and he said, "Hey, come on down. I'll lend you a manual." And as you know, the computer and the console manual are the size of phone books. So he dropped these two things into my lap and said, "Happy reading." And I can't tell you how many times I read those things from front to back and, just learned about signal flow and how to run, just gain structures. And so really a lot was just reading and just putting it to use.
So was that the console that you originally learned on then? Was it an SSL?
If I were to say the absolute first consoles, it was an MCI 636 would be the very, very first. And then it was an SSLG and E.
It was a MCI 416 for me.
Oh, wow. Really, huh?
Yeah, the old black ones.
Yeah, the 636 with the multi-track with the fake wood on it. I used to call it the Country Squire. Remember, like the station wagons from the 70s?
I remember. I do.
Well, none of us should be able to remember that, Bob. We're only 29.
Yeah,
remember?
Yeah, that's right. Well, it's cool. We have similar backgrounds because, you know, I, like everybody else, I started as a musician and was, that's all I did, you know, into my 40s, basically. And then decided it was a lot more fun to be in the studio.
Sure.
You know, and it was, and you didn't have to travel and, you know, no bad experiences. So, well, no, let's put it like this. At least the bad experiences were close to home.
Well, and you know what? The thing is, when you're going from working from artist to artist, you know, there is, for me, I found there was a distinctive, like a creative outlet that I would get as a guitar player, but you're also doing it. It's kind of, you join families temporarily from anywhere from, you know, whatever it is, a week to, I mean, I've had records that have lasted, you know, a year. Yeah. So, you know, you join these families and you move on. And that actually was an added benefit, I guess you could say, where you'd say, you know, this was a really great project and you have something fresh that you're doing that is, it's a whole bunch of new people and there's a whole new creative approach, you know? So it was, you know, that's one of the things I find that's particularly satisfying about what I'm doing.
Were you ever an assistant?
You know, I assisted on a total of one album. I worked with I was working with a producer engineer named Joe Hardy. Do you know Joe Hardy?
No, I don't.
Joe Hardy he worked with ZZ Top forever.
Oh, okay. And right.
Yeah, he's from Ardent. He's like, yeah, from the whole Ardent clan. Remarkably talented guy. And I was working with a band called a guitar player named Jeff Healy.
Oh.
And
yeah.
Jeff Healy, he got asked to do a Jeff Healy record, and the band said, listen, you know, if you want to assist, because I was kind of their house guy at the time, and he said, if you want to assist, you know, it'd be a good opportunity. And he was just such a great guy. It was just, we spent more time laughing than anything else, you know, and that's actually one of the things that he taught me is, you know, it's not rocket science, you know, we're not cleaning out the Slurpee machines at 7-Eleven, so enjoy the gig instead of, you know, look at all the great things that are going on instead of saying, you know, I need this to be better. I need that to be better because, you know, we're all blessed with a pretty great gig.
Did you do that album at Ardent?
No, we did it actually up at in Toronto. Joe brought I don't know how many fridges worth of gear he brought up, which was a terrible thing. It was like the rock of crack that man brought in. You know what I mean? He brought this thing in and it's like, I need that.
Yeah.
So, no, it just started my slow downturn of gear buying, you know, it's just awful. But no, it was, we did it up in Toronto. We just brought a whole bunch of gear into Jeff's studio and we tracked it all there and then mixed it at a SSL place in Toronto.
I was at Ardent about 6 months ago and it was a great place. It was, you know, like walking through history.
It is so historic there, isn't it?
Yeah, and people are great, and it's just great. I'm hoping to do a record there pretty soon. I'm trying to get everybody to go there, and I think I have just about convinced them, so that'll be
amazing.
A lot of fun, yeah.
That's going to be fantastic.
Yeah, definitely, it'll be good.
Great.
I read somewhere about the fact that you use as many as 40 microphones on Neil and Mike, and I know they have big drum kits, but wow, that's a lot of mics.
It is a lot. Well, you know what? In defense of that, a lot of it is spot miking. If you look at the kit, if you look at both of their drum kits, they use a lot of like splash cymbals and these very subtle sonic elements that. Either Mike or Neil, both of them would say, you know, I kind of need to hear, I've got this 4-inch splash cymbal. Can you bring that out a little bit more? You know, and it really, a lot of the microphones come from that. I mean, Mike, Mangini's kit, he has a set of, he has eight toms and four octos, overhead. So, you know, there's 12, But a lot of his core elements, you know, with the, you know, if somebody's got a single kick with, you know, three mics on a kick drum, each of them doing different things. But then, you know, Mike has four kick drums. So, you know, there's, you know, that in itself just chews up 12 mics, right?
Yeah.
But it's a lot of it is, I mean, I have a set of like core, you know, overheads and room mics and anything that does strong imaging of the kit. You know, those are going to stay consistent regardless of kit size. And then a lot of it's just spot miking. So, you know, we do try to keep everything as phase accurate as possible. But it's just a lot of it's just from the player and having, you know, so many different elements to mic up.
Yeah. How do you deal with phase? What do you do?
Tape measure. Tape measure is a big one. Depending on the kit, both Neil and Mike, their kits are both immense, but the layout is completely different. Mangini's kit is laid out more of a snare. Snare is dead center of the kit, and then his all of his elements, toms and cymbals, are laid out in a inverted V toward him. So his kit is actually very central. Neil's is more of a classic setup where the snare drum is audience perspective toward the right. So with Neil's kit, what I end up doing with phase is I actually have turned like the any imaging microphones are actually turned about 10 degrees clockwise so that the kicks and snares are aligned in a straight line, right? So you don't have that feeling of either kick is center and snare is slightly right, or you know, snare is center and kick is slightly left. So you know just turning the microphones ever so slightly clockwise realigns the drums within the sonic image that both kick and snare are in the center.
Mm.
You know,
that's cool.
And then it's all tape measure. You know, when I first started working with Neil, and Neil's a very introspective guy. So out of the whole band, he basically took the longest to get to know. And the first project I was working on, he came in a touch early to start warming up, and he's playing, and literally he was, you know, doing snare rolls, and I start like measuring, and I just putting tape measure right onto his snare drum. Right. Doesn't really know me, just looking at this guy, you know. He's just like, are you from a hardware show, buddy, or what, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm measuring all the mics, the overheads from this, because I maintain the distance from snare to microphone so that the image remains stable. And so I was just measuring all the mics all around, all the overhead mics, so everything is phase accurate to the snare. And he was really pleased with the effect, so that's great.
What do you do mixing that many drum mics then? What's your procedure?
A lot of house cleaning, right? Any of the elements that are, if there's an element that's not being used, then it's out, right? So mm-hmm. anything with, what I'll do is I'll create a set of spot elements. I'll actually mix them down to like a surround subgroup. Right, I'll mix it in like 5.0 for cymbals, say, and I'll recreate a subgroup where the panning matches within the subgroup, right? Yeah. And it's just see, that's the surround police driving up right now. So I'll actually take all those mics and all the elements of all of these sort of the spot elements, and I'll submix those, and then I'll add those in to the overheads as needed, right?
Yeah.
So really, it's a simplification. As far as toms go, I will do tom rides manually within Pro Tools. Tom rides, like for Mangini's kit or Neil's kit, I'll go through and ride essentially gating, but it's done manually so that the gates, there's no chattering, right? Because it's cumulative, right? If you have 12 mics that are chattering open and close, it's not going to sound very pleasing. So I literally do all the rides within the drum kit manually. So, you know, if he hits a floor tom once, it just opens up, and then it's, I have it slowly brought down about 15, 20 dB. So they don't close completely. So I don't want it to sound sampley, but it's just, it keeps all the mics, keeps all the ambience under control. So it doesn't end up that we've got these weird phase things where you have a ride that is mic'd up, and then you've got, you know, the ride coming in from the tom mics. So you get this, some of these odd anomalies. So it really takes care of that really easily.
Are you writing the faders, or are you drawing that in, drawing the automation?
I completely draw it in. draw it in, because if you try and write it, the being able to draw it in is you can just go right up to the transient, right? It's literally listen to each track, listen to the drums, and draw it in. And here's some of the decay times are, you know, it's listen to the drums, see what it's doing, get a reasonable amount of decay, and then surround police are coming in. Anyways, get a reasonable amount of decay, and sometime, you know, if you get to end of a song where, you know, maybe the song ends in a tom hit, you know, we'll draw out a longer decay, but it's just to keep the kick completely natural and just keep the phase under control, right? So we don't end up with strange artifacts.
I love drawing automation in. I got to say, I never liked console automation, fader automation. It always seemed like it was a lot harder than it should be, first of all. And now it takes no time at all to draw it in. I mean, you just look at what you have to do. You draw it in. If you don't like it, you draw that or clip gain, one or the other.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, clip gain, both of them have a different, if you're mixing in the box, right, your fader, doing your fade gain is going to be pre-plugins.
Yeah.
If you're going to do your fader rides, then you're going to be post plugins, right? So it's a completely different effect. That's not super relevant, say for toms, but if I were doing like gain rides, say for guitars, where that's going to be a guitar signal that you're going to overdrive later, then you're going to get a different set of artifacts, right? You're going to be at the mercy of adding a lot of gain to your rides, your gain rides done to the track, right?
Right, right. How much mixing in the box do you do?
Quite a lot. Most of my mixing is in the box, except for the last Dream Theater record, Dream Theater 12, that was mixed on a duality. I go between mixing, if I'm doing a surround project, I mix entirely in the box. If I'm mixing in stereo, then I kind of bounce between either mixing in the box, and I also have an SSL Sigma, an SSL Sigma that I use as well. So it's kind of a hybrid approach.
When you're mixing in surround, what's your approach? Is it the same as stereo? Do you think differently? Do you approach it differently? Do you set up differently? How does that work for you?
Definitely, setup is different. I try to discuss that with the client first off at the very beginning of any project to say, are we going to go surround? Because in a perfect world, it's always I think there's a little bit better results to go in and record and, you know, be able to say, you know what, I've got some extra elements for the drums. I've got some extra elements for orchestra. You know, just any of the instrumentation that would really benefit from adding a few microphones to get some additional space and try and make it authentic, right? Authentic miking of it, so it's not, I don't know if gimmicky is the right term, but, you know, you just want to have it so it's I prefer very realistic sound to surround, to feel like you're in the room with the drums, you know? So, you know, I'll put up extra mics for that anyways. And you know, my approach for mixing is going to be, I have a tendency to want to do, I don't use fold downs for a stereo mix. I'll do a stereo mix and I want to make sure that the client is happy with the imaging and the blends of instruments. And then I'll put it out into surround and then add in, say, if I've got mics that I've put up for the drums that were specifically for surround, I'll start to add those in for the surround mix. So I end up mixing the album twice, more or less.
Most of the surround mixing you're doing is two picture, right?
Yes and no. I mean, I did for all the live stuff that I do, it's to picture. But for Universal had a mandate to reissue all of the Rush catalog that was on the Universal and its subsidiaries up to, I think it was about 1989. They were with Universal. So I mean, I ended up remixing. Let me think. Fly By Night, I did 2112, I did Moving Pictures, Signals, Farewell to Kings. Those were all in surround, right? Those were all in surround with put onto Blu-ray. And I think they just had, I know on 2112 they had some cartoon animation elements, and I don't know what they had on any of the other releases, but there was no picture that I was aware of, like no video elements.
So did that change your approach to the surround mix? Did you have more in the rear? How did you do it?
Approach, you mean live versus recording?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, it definitely. For surround for live, I like to keep a very strong audience perspective. So definitely the band is in front and there's reflections. I'll listen to the hall by itself. I'll spend a lot of time just listening to room mics and listen what's going on and see what's bouncing into the rear mics. And I'll listen to the effects that the front of house sound man's using. Mm-hmm. And then I'll listen to that and I'll try to get a good recreation of what the front of house guy is doing, and then being able to add in the audience. So it really feels like you're there. And you're not at the mercy of the sonics of the room, if I could say that.
Yeah.
Or you could say, well, I couldn't really make out those delays because, you know, and I can bring out those delays in a mix and really keep them so they're firing in behind you to make generate some excitement for the mix. From a studio point of view, different approach. It's especially for a band like Rush, there's a lot more of a chance to experiment. Right. So
yeah.
I would move. I mean, we would move a lot of things around. Now, with Rush, it was not what they had wanted to do was a recreation of the original mix. So, you know, it was EQing it. So it felt had the same bottom end, same level of compression. So, you know, there's definitely the heritage factor there to maintain the heritage of the original mix. But again, trying to get it so it's interesting. And taking elements, definitely firing a lot of elements in rear. I mean, I heard a lot of things where when I did the remix of Limelight, people are saying, "Oh my God, Getty was in the studio. He re-recorded some background vocal. I heard a background vocal in the second verse, and it's a harmonizer that's bent down a fifth. It's on the original album, but the mix, it's so low in the original mix. And when I heard it in the multi, I went, God, that's such an interesting thing. And I put it right in the rear speakers, figuring, well, everyone's going to hear this. And everybody heard it and went, oh my God, they're re-recording it. It's sacrilege.
Yeah. You have to be careful, just, Rush fans, definitely.
Yeah, but it was all there. It was great. You know what? I think that it's a really great thing to show people. That was always there on the album. It's just, it's so low in the mix. You know, if you pop on a good set of headphones, you can hear it. But it's one of those things that when you actually physically take it, remove it from the density of the front channels and put it in behind you, you know, all of a sudden there's this, oh, wow, that's really great. And you know what? If it's giving listeners a new experience and something new to listen to of an album that's 20 or 30 years old, I think that's a great thing. It's win-win for everybody.
Yeah, definitely. How do you approach the LFE? What do you put down there? Or do you put anything?
Oh, great question. The LFE for me is, let's look at the both approaches. For live, I'll use the LFE like a subwoofer. I'll put a little bit of kick drum, a little bit of bass, right? So depending on the band, if it's like the heavier guitar bass band, I'll put maybe a little touch of the guitars in there so that when they palm mute, you can feel the you get a little bit of that in there. And then of course, what I love is I'll use the as a sub, and I use it as an LFE for pyro.
Mm.
Right. So pyro. So when there's something that goes, because sometimes I'll get in recordings and the visual of it is so amazing that, you know, it's just, this thing looks like a bomb going off and all you'll hear is
yeah.
From the audio. Right. So, you know, I'll get so much, I'll drive so much down into the LFE that it's sounds like what it looks like. The video guys did a great job filming, and you got to get the sonic. So it feels like there's a bomb going off. It sounds like there's a bomb going off.
Are you adding sound effects at that point?
That is recording dependent. So yeah. There have been times where I didn't have to, and then there's been times where, for whatever reason, there's literally no low end. You drive it down into the LFE, and there's nothing there. Yeah. Then I'll add in something to give it some power, but it's literally on a case by case basis, and it's only in the LFE, and it's only to give you the to give you the experience so your eyes and ears match up.
You know? What are you using for surround speakers, for a surround sound setup?
I use Focal SM9s.
Oh, okay.
So they're big speakers, you know, yeah. Focal SM9s. And I had a set of, a lot of the work that I'd done were Yamaha MSP10s and a SW10 sub, right? And monitoring with an Icon.
Single sub?
I use a single sub.
Yeah.
My mix room is about 450 square feet, so it's not a cavern. So I think if I had more physical room volume, I would need more. But I try to keep my mix level under wraps. So, you know, if I would start to add a lot of huge speakers and, you know, have a pair of subs, I could just see myself getting into trouble having myself at 120 dB for 8 hours, Bobby. Not the best thing.
Yeah, right. Coming back to some of the live mixing that you're doing, I'm curious how you handled the audience, because there's two schools of thought. One is you add it in the beginning, uh-huh. and it's part of the bed of the song, and the other is you add it in at the end as, you know, an enhancement. What's your approach?
That changes. That's on a case by case basis. For the audience itself, really a lot of the audience is, we're looking at, for me, I'm looking at room ambience. So if there's a project that I'm recording for live, I'll go out and I'll put 10 room mics in. And what we're looking for in the room is a really great ambient sound, notwithstanding the audience yet, but it's the ambient sound within those audience mics.
Yeah.
That is the biggest thing for me to achieve, is that when I turn this up, does this give is this a good ambience? I have to EQ it. You know, how does this support the direct signals from the stage? And I find that is really that's my marker of how I'm going to proceed. If there is if there's a really great miking setup, if the setup works and we've got a really great room sound, you know, then the audience tracks are on my side, right? And yeah. If not, then it's one of those things where, well, we have to kind of going to EQ it down so the ambience is reduced. We add ambience, and we use those room mics are used more for crowd purposes only, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Because if it's a crappy sounding room, Bobby, it's just not going to be a good mix when it's done.
Do you have an approach or a trick to recording ambience, recording the room? There's a lot of different approaches to that. There must be a dozen different ways to do it that I've seen, and I don't know if there's a better one than any other one. How do you do it?
Well, the rooms, you know what? All rooms are so different, right? It's what I end up doing is I'll have sets of microphones that are hanging within the room and at the very back of the room, I should say behind the sound man, mm-hmm. I usually have a Blumline pair of ribbon mics. And what I've been finding is that the Blumline pair of ribbon mics behind the sound man have been yielding the best sound out of like all mics that come down the sides, right? Because I'll mic up from very close to stage and then have them equally spaced down toward the back. And what I found is the Blumline pair has been the most satisfying, where it has the randomness in the crowd, right? Where you're not picking up, you know, the single claps that make it sound like, wow, is that microphone really close to somebody? You know, that sort of, yeah. Doesn't have that issue. And sonically, I've found that I've had the best luck with that so far from venue to venue. It's been prominent in a lot of the mixes that I've done.
What mics are you using?
I've been using either AT 4080s, the Audio Technica 4080s, or I'll use a pair of Royers.
The SF24s?
A pair of 121s. I haven't got the SF24 from them yet, but I actually, I've got one coming in, so I'm going to have to check it out.
That's a great mic, actually. Yeah. You're gonna dig it. Uh-huh. So let's come back to mixing. So you're mixing in the box mostly then, right? Except when there's a console available, I guess, right? Yeah. Well, yeah, you're mixing in a box, but you have an Icon, right?
Yes.
You have a controller. What Do you have certain plugins that you always use?
I have a lot of go-to ones. I love all of the Collins plugins, the McDSP plugins. I use a lot of the Sonox, plugins as well. Really fantastic sounding. I'm trying to think what somebody put up on my Tubus. I mean, a lot of Universal, I've got a great relationship with Universal Audio. So we use, I got a lot of stuff I use from them. Mm-hmm. And those are kind of my three go-to main brands. I do a few things, got some stuff I use with Waves as well. But you know, a lot of the EQing, I mean, the UA SSL plugins, which sounds strange in itself, but the UA SSL plugins sound really stellar, as do the SSL plugins. The sound I really enjoy is, I really enjoy that sort of SSL grab of the console itself. So, I mean, in a simplest form, that's what I end up doing, is I recreate that SSL grab and byte that the console has. I recreate that in the box.
What's your approach when you're mixing something that you didn't track? Do you go in cold and just mix what you have, or do you listen to rough mixes beforehand, or how do you do that?
I find that speaking with the artist is more beneficial than listening to the rough mix. So I find that speaking with the artist and finding out what they want is more critical than going through and listening to a rough mix, because if there's a mix already in existence, they're not happy with it. So I don't want to listen to something they're not happy with.
I've always found that too. They always give you a rough mix, and I try not to listen to it unless there's an issue that comes up later and somebody says, well, didn't you listen to the rough mix? Or we liked that in a rough mix.
Then I'll go back and reference it. Yeah, if there's something there that would come up in our preliminary conversation, if they'd say, yeah, you know, I really like this, this spinny effect, say, I like this spinny effect in the bridge. And then I'll go, what? Okay. My head goes, okay, what is spinny? Yeah. So then I'll refer to the mix and say, what is he looking for? Oh, it's a flanger. Oh, it's a phaser. Or, you know, oh, he pans the whole mix left to right or something, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, if there's something that what he is saying, he's referring to the mix and it's not really, and it's not clear, then I'll refer to the, definitely refer to the rough mix. But I have a tendency to shy away from it and just kind of learn what the band's about, where they want to go with it, and go from there.
Switching subjects just a little bit. When you're recording guitars, you always take a DI too, don't you?
Always take a DI. There have been times where we would, great case in point, last Dream Theater record, John is a Mesa Boogie lover, great sounding amps, and we were listening. We had a great sound out of a Mark 2C Plus amp. We had a great sound out of a Mark 5. And so we recorded it, and he goes, I don't know. I'm just wondering if the other amp would sound better. And this is, I mean, we're talking about a song that's 12 minutes long maybe, right?
Yeah.
So 12 minutes long, a lot of punch-ins, a lot of records that went. Instead of saying, well, let's re-record it and see how it sounds, we just go back, grab the DI, fire it back out to the other amp, and we record another track and said, great, let's A-B.
Makes a lot of sense.
Big time saver for that, big time saver for big time saver for if you're live and there's any issue with the live sound, that you can go back and, you know, call the artist and say, well, we need to just mic up your live rig and we're going to run the show again. Because there might have been some clicks, ticks, you know, any sort of anomalies. And it's also great that if you need to do any editing, right, if you need to do any editing, you have the DI has got all the transients, especially with a high-gain player, right? Our high-gain player, his performance is going to look more like a audio sausage,
yeah,
right? But when you have the DI track, you've got a good transient, and you could see his timing and all that sort of stuff. So it makes life a lot easier and a lot of avenues.
Do you process it at all or just record it flat?
I record it flat. I just have a limiter on it that hits just before clipping the DAW in case, you know, if he really digs in on the guitar and hits it hard, I just don't want to clip the DAW.
Yeah.
So I just have that safety valve. Other than that, no processing.
That's a great idea. More people should do that, including me. But, you know, just for what you say, just for editing, it makes a lot of sense, because one of the hardest things to do is take distorted guitars and try to figure out the beginning and the end of a note. Dude, or a chord.
It is the easiest thing. Put the DI on, just look, you know, and you just trim. The only thing is that the DI is a little bit deceptive, because, you know, when you look at the DI and then say it goes through, you know, it's a good 60, 70 dB of gain, say through guitar amp. Right.
Yeah.
And then, so what you see, you go, oh yeah, well, there's this very clear cut transient. And that is where the main transient is. But there's all of this little noise that's just beforehand that if it's cut off abruptly, you know, all of a sudden the guitar track doesn't feel natural anymore. So, you know, it's a little bit of a process to figure out the player and sort of how they generate self-noise and how to make the editing natural to match his self-noise. Because, you know, some players are very tight when they play, and some, you know, there's a lot of breathing that they do, and, you know, you have to kind of take that into effect before you start editing with just the DI. It's definitely a combination of looking at both the direct waveform and the amplified waveform.
Boy, you must have a lot of tracks when you mix.
Yes. Well, it builds up, you know, last Dream Theater record was, the largest song was about 160 tracks. So it's big. A lot of this, we end up doing some, end up doing some mixing down though during the process. Before we started to go into the mix studio, I took about a week to go through the album and basically reduce it, you know, see where there's some imaging, say some guitar imaging that was consistent. We'd say, great, I'll bounce that down to stereo. Keyboards, well, you know, I had some elements that were similar, and we'd say, well, you know, there's three different flavors of piano in this one song. We're going to bounce that down to a single stereo pair of tracks, so that sort of thing. So, I mean, you tame it one way or another. It's really no different than a movie. A movie is a great example where you end up with all of these tracks, and you comb through them a few times, and you reduce it down to what you have in the theater. Slowly but surely, it'll happen.
How long does it take you to do a mix?
If everything is clean, and sometimes songs mix themselves, Bobby. You know, if there's a natural flow to the arranged instrumentation, I mean, it could be as short as 4 hours, can be as long as, I've had ones that are 3 days. So yeah. There's no rules. There's no rules at all.
Well, I guess when you're mixing in a box, it's like everybody else, where you mix one song for a while, and you go to another one, and do a round robin on it. So do you do that?
I have a tendency to, I'll wrap up the song, and I mean, you know, mixing in the box, the great thing about mixing in the box is the idea that, you know, you could go through and do all your work, and artists will come back and say, you know, I really like this part. I think maybe the vocal in the bridge could come up a dB, and you know, you just open it up 90 seconds later, boom, you're up and you're printed. So there's not that physical recall, which is incredibly time consuming. Now the other side of that is that you've got all these little minutia details now that come in. You know, the drummer is saying that the 37th hi-hat hit needs to come up. And, you know, and you're in doing a recall. So, you know, you can end up, instead of having, say, a situation where you do, say, from one, maybe two recalls, all of a sudden you're into 12 or 13 recalls. And it might be something, the first mix that you did 4 weeks ago, let's go back and there's some very subtle details, which, I mean, it's not a bad thing, but it's one of those things that the time before the mixes formally signed off on, that time is getting longer because of the possibility of being able to do last minute changes.
Bruce Swedeen told me when they were recording Billie Jean, Michael Jackson's Billie Jean, they did 99 mixes, and they went back to number two.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
99 mixes and go back to number two.
But
all that tape, that was all done to tape, right?
All the tape, yeah, yeah. Whoa. But it just goes to show you sometimes your initial reaction, your initial impulses are best. And, you know, you can work something to death. But, you know, the other thing is, I forget who told me this. I think it was Ken Scott, actually. And it's something that he does when he mixes, and he tells everybody in the band, basically, look, you're not going to remember that hi-hat wasn't loud enough 2 weeks from now.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the case. You know, people will complain about something, and then they'll forget what it was that, you know, was causing him such grief, you know,
sure,
during that time.
Sure. You know, I mean, a lot of it is it a great song? Is it a great performance? And that's the stuff that we're really trying to, you know, as for what we do, that's, you know, we're just a vehicle to help the artist do that, right?
Yeah right.
If we want to mix something. You know, for me, I love it when a mix kicks in and, you know, you could see the adrenaline kick up in somebody and they're enjoying what they're hearing. And if that's a vehicle to help them hear the song, then I couldn't be any happier. So, you know, all the little tiny details, I agree with you. I mean, I don't think it's one of those things that, you know, you're going to get a song on, you know, try and get a song on the radio and they're going to say, well, yes, I really enjoyed the song, but the hi-hat is just not loud enough.
Yeah,
therefore, right. We're going to move to a more qualified hi-hat song.
Yeah, right.
Still think it's going to happen.
All right, do you still play?
I wish I did, Bob. I do play a bit, but it's one of those things that it's been so busy, you know, and jumping from project to project. I try to do a bit of songwriting, but it's just been so back-to-back right now that... It's one of those things I have to sit down and say, you know, I have all of the resources to record a record. I really should, you know?
Yeah. Well, hey, it's a blessing and a curse to be busy, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah. Last question. Yeah. What's the best piece of business advice that you've learned through your career or someone imparted to you?
You know what? We said, I think we did discuss, we touched on it at the very beginning, is the whole idea of having a really great time and a great relationship with an artist, you know,
yeah.
all of that stuff you can hear, you know, you can hear it in recordings. And, you know, like I see stuff on YouTube that an artist has posted, artists have posted, and, you know, some of the stuff that they say is, you know, we did this record and, you know, they said, you know, and that's all the technical stuff. We say, oh, I really enjoyed the stuff that Rich Chickie did, blah, blah, blah. And then they start to talk about how much fun it was. How they were laughing and how they had a great time doing a record. And, you know, for me, that's the biggest, that is the biggest compliment, that they had a great time doing this.
Yeah.
Because I think that's how you get clients that are, you know, you have clients for 10 years because they enjoy it. Hey, we're going to have a great time. Let's do this and make a good record. And I mean, for God's sakes, we're making records for a living. I mean, you know, how could life be any better?
It's supposed to be fun, right?
Right, exactly. And it's one of those things that, you know, if you're having a really crappy time recording an album, that's going to make it to your record. You know, if you have that, all the angst and, you know, and it's a difficult record, personally, I think you could hear that. And I think it's one of those things when you have a really great time and you hear that on a record, then, you know, all of a sudden the feedback, it sort of manifests itself in different ways. You know, you see it in reviews, they'll say, the band really sounded like they were hot working together, or, you know, they sound fresh, they sound young and alive. They said, these are all the things that manifest themselves because they're having a great time and they're locking. They're thinking about how they're playing. They're not thinking about, you know, that they're having a crappy time.
Yeah.
So for me, I think that's the biggest thing is get the artist comfortable, have a really, really great time. Think about how fortunate you are and make great records.
Well, speaking of a good time, this was a great time for me. I really enjoyed it.
It's been so much fun, Bobby.
It's always fun to talk to somebody about surround, especially because there's not too many of us that practice it. And especially lately, I haven't done a surround record in years. I haven't been asked to. And the fact that you're doing them right now, I think is very cool. That's great.
No, I appreciate it. Well, you know what? I just want to tell you, when I've had some people tell me, is there still a demand for surround? And Rush, I use Rush as my example. Over the history of me working with the band, we together in total, we've earned 26 gold and platinum awards for albums and DVDs. And that's in Canada and the USA. Out of those 26 gold and platinum albums, 24 of them are for surround.
Wow.
Right?
Wow. So
right? It's right up. Go to RIAA, go to CREA.ca or RIAA.org. Do the math, 26 albums, and 24 of them are surround. So I don't know. I think that there's still a pretty good market. Like when you take figures like that, that's a pretty good market.
Yeah. Yeah, you know? I'll say. Well, hopefully more people get into it and there'll be more demand for it.
That'd be fantastic.
That'd be great. Thank you so much, Rich. This has been terrific. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks, Bobby. All the best.
To find out more about Richard, go to his website at richardchichi.com. That's Richard, C-H-Y-C-H-I.com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, send them to questions at bobbyoinnercircle.com. Many thanks to Steve Cherubino, who's the host of the EDM Producer Podcast at edmmr.com. He helps put the show together, and I really appreciate it. Thank you, Steve. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, or you can find it on iTunes or Stitcher. At bobbyosinski.com, you'll find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I'll see you next time.